Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up later on Main Street, our good friend Dr. Tom Ezern stops by. His new Plainsfolk essay, Maggie. It's about a song that became a sentimental anthem of love and loss for frontier communities. We'll have a report from Harvest Public Media about chokeberries. But we open today's show with Prairie Pulse, which is a weekly public affairs show on the television service of Prairie Public. And this week, John Harris, the president and CEO of Prairie Public, welcomes Fargo Mayor Tim Mahoney and photographer Andy Hall.
Hello, and welcome to Prairie Pulse. Joining us now is longtime Fargo Mayor Dr. Tim Mahoney.
Thanks, John, for saying that's a long time. But yeah, it started in 2014, and it's been going ever since.
As you get started, tell the folks a little bit about yourself and your background.
So my background is I'm actually a general surgeon. I've been doing general surgery for 50 years now, basically, and got into politics in 2005. 2005, I became a commissioner, and when Denny Wallacher died in 2014, I became mayor.
Let's talk about Fargo in itself, just kind of the growth. You know, what's going on in Fargo right now?
Well, what people have to remember is our community is a growing city, and it has grown quite a bit. In 1990, we had 74,000 residents. Now we're up to 133,000 people. That's an 80% increase of people. In the last 10 years, we've grown 20%. So we continue to have a good growth, good balance as a community. Socioeconomically, we have manufacturing, medicine, education, agriculture. It all mixes to make a nice socioeconomic mix so the community continues to thrive.
How would you say Fargo differs from the other cities in North Dakota?
So we kind of like to have that small town feel, but yet we're a metro area. So a lot of people come here and say, gee, different restaurants I've never seen before, different opportunities for entertainment, different educational opportunities. Research is really hot. We have a lot of entrepreneurs as well going in the community. So we're a very dynamic community. Many people, when I interview them, why did you move to Fargo? It's the energy they feel in the community. So we feel that we, for the state of North Dakota, are an answer to many questions of bringing people in and have a job. 5,000 jobs are available at any one time in our community. We have an opportunity for people to come and find a place to work.
Can you tell us about the proposed Red River Community Service Center?
So in our community, we've had ever since COVID went and came, we used to have rent support, in which we supported people in rental. That's gone away. More people are entered into the homeless area than ever did before. So we have 1,000 people that are homeless any one time in our metro area. We try to find housing for those people throughout the area. And that's a difficult task at times. So we have some unhoused people that are coming down the downtown area. And one of the things that started in 2018 is when we had COVID money, we had to have a center to take care of people who had COVID because we needed a place to shelter them. It started out in regards to that, and then it evolved into we have a place in which people can engage, get medical care, psych care, get housing, get different things that they need to get, and that was what's called the DEC or the Engagement Center. As we've gone through this now, we had some consultants from Bloomberg come out and look at our problem and kind of look at what we need, and we're saying, what do other cities do? How do other people manage this issue of the homeless around the country? And basically are trying to set up what we would call the service center. So in a service center, the difference from the engagement center is you have your providers in the service center, your nonprofits, your different people. You would have the FM Coalition for Homelessness in the center helping get people housing. You have a medical clinic. You would have psych services available. You could have a place where you could detox people and take them where they need to go. When that has been talked about, we also talked about maybe a deflection center. Now, a deflection center would basically be 40% of our homeless have mental health issues. The difficulty oftentimes, if you drop them into an ER or drop them someplace, they're discharged out back homeless again because they're not qualified for in-house hospitalization. What you have to have someplace for those people to go, and sometimes those people are the bothersome people downtown that are bothering you as you're walking along. So state of North Dakota, in Fargo at least, we don't have a real good place to try to manage somebody who's having a crisis. Oftentimes they're having the crisis in the middle of the street or somewhere else. People feel uncomfortable with that. A deflection center in the centers we've seen is an opportunity, instead of my policeman being tied up 3 or 4 hours with somebody who's having a crisis, we could bring them over to the deflection center and psych workers could begin to work with that person. Police officer could leave and go out to the business they have to do.
You mentioned Bloomberg Associates. What kind of input did you get from them?
So Linda Gibb was a deputy mayor in New York City and she had tackled the homelessness under Mike Bloomberg. Now there's a foundation that we work with mayors to help you do stuff. What we've looked at is 20 different cities and how they've tackled this and what they've done in regards to this, trying to find the right mix for Fargo. People have spent a lot of money in this area. People have done a lot of different programs in this area. What we're discovering is homelessness won't go away, so you have to take care of it if you're dealing with it, but how do you best deal with it? And if we can get people into housing first, that's what people have tried to do. Now, what we talked about is a master lease. That's one of the things we've been talking about. Now, what's a master lease? Well, that's different than a regular lease. So if you went out and got an apartment right now, it's your name on the apartment, you're taking care of that. On a master lease, we have our nonprofit step in and be the landlord, basically, of the lease. So if the person is having difficulties mentally or a support system is not there, that we step in there and help that out. Basically, a nonprofit would be helping with support services. So if Charlie was in a center and he was having a psychotic reaction or something, you wouldn't call the landlord. You'd actually call this master lease landlord, which would be a nonprofit that's in this area. They would go out to the apartment and try to deal with it. The problem is, if they needed to go see psych services, if they needed to go see a psychiatrist, and you go to the hospital, it's managed that way. And that way you can keep those people in their apartments. So, you know, if you're having a crisis and a mental health crisis, oftentimes it's loud, it's noisy, it's those types of things. That offers an opportunity for us to help get that person the help they need.
How about now long-term shelter and housing needs?
So the FM Coalition for Homelessness is going to be working with United Way, and they've come up with a program to bring all the partners together that do housing and housing the homeless, and they will work up as a combined team to help us find places for people to be. The master lease program would be part of the thing they would manage. They're going to raise $2.5 million to help United Way get into this arena, but basically it would be City of Fargo would step back. They would do the major work to try to get people into housing and get them in those places. We have like 40 vouchers out there right now, people who have vouchers to rent places but cannot find a place to rent. So it would be an aggressive way of looking at that, getting a master lease, see if we get people in apartments. That's half of what's holding us up, is the inability to place them in apartments. Other thing that's happening in the community right now is our vacancy rate in apartments is 7 to 8%. So typically when that happens, you are more inclined to be able to find housing for people. So that's our hope, is that we'll have more housing opportunities open up.
So will the city do oversight of it, or will the master lease charity really take charge of it?
FM Coalition for Homelessness would manage that. So the city would back out of that location, and then Presentation Sisters also help this as well. So we have different partners that get in that arena. United, the Churches United helps in their areas. They have 120 people they take care of. Frequently, they're taking care of mothers and children and different mission statement for them. But we would work together with all the partners in the Fargo-Moorhead area and have us work together to get people into housing.
Okay. What about the cost of the center? How is it going to be paid for?
Well, right now, I proposed when we went forward to the governor, we just talked to Kelly Armstrong about this proposal, and he's excited about it if we can offload some of the work that the policemen have to do to get them into some type of center or overall place. The idea of the service center is to bring your nonprofits and different people together to service people, and since then, the city doesn't carry all that cost. We believe for the city, we would have to put $2.5 million into purchase or into getting improvements. We're going to ask the private sector for $2.5 million, and then we're going to ask the state for $2.5 million. So that should give us a cost estimate of $7.5 million to take a building and bring it to the site we want to do. We also then could have partners rent parcels of the building, so it would not all be all Fargo. Maybe have the county get involved, maybe West Fargo gets involved. So then you have more partnerships in this effort, because it's an effort for the whole community. And it's important to have people come to the table that help us out in dealing with this issue.
So I assume one of the crucial steps is getting consensus among the commissioners. I mean, all the commissioners don't see eye to eye on this issue. Can you talk about that and the difficulty of gaining that consensus?
Basically, the consensus we have from the commissioners right now is they would like the present site where the engagement center is moved. It's a sense amongst many people that if we could move it from that present location, it would be better. Downtown business partners seem to want that as well as my commission. So that's part one, is I do think I have a consensus on there. Where it moves to is the contentious part, is we don't quite know where it needs to move, but it has to be on a bus route, it has to be walkable, it has to be where people will seek the services. So if I move it 2 miles from downtown, what will happen is people will not walk 2 miles downtown. They oftentimes then will just congregate downtown. And that's really what people don't want, is to have people in all the retail shops along Broadway. So what we'd rather do is if we can have it, you know, a little bit more in an industrial site and a little bit off site, but able to be accessible, that's a site we're looking for. We have looked at 10 different sites. We've got maybe two or three that we're very interested in.
Now, you mentioned downtown businesses and patrons, I think. You know, how has the homeless issue affected downtown businesses?
Well, what's happened is if you look at what's going on, economy or across the country, is there was a slowdown just before the election. I think everybody felt that. And you can do it on a variety of different reasons. I'm downtown. I find it very busy, things going on. But what's happening is that there's a concern. Crime is down. Crime rates are down downtown. When we looked at the statistics the Chief Sabowski brought out, the crime rate is actually down. What we're really looking at is there's people that panhandle or people that are in the street sometime that are uncomfortable for patrons that are downtown. And what we have to do is to try to address that and see what we could do to improve that experience when you're downtown. So that's the goal of the police chief. He's working with the engagement center. Now, what you don't know, John, is that we have what we call a mobile one unit and a mobile two unit. And what that is, people from the harm reduction program will go out into the street and go to businesses, go along the street, do things. And if somebody's being bothersome, say, hey, let's go somewhere else, or let's pick you up and do something else. Oftentimes removing them from that area. Last year, they had almost 250 runs a month that they would do, and they were doing this to help improve the experience downtown. And what we're doing is we're going to work with the police chief, work with the harm reduction people, work with the county, work with everybody kind of as a group, and say, how can we make the downtown experience better? And that's what we're going to be doing now. That's the goal of this year, is to make it so people feel more comfortable downtown.
Sure. Is the Fargo Civic Center a possibility for a long-term solution? I know it's been at least rumored that might be a possibility.
You know, we looked at the Fargo Civic Center actually 3 or 4 years ago as a possibility if we could do that. And logistically, it just doesn't set up right for it. It's just, it's clumsy as far as what you need to have. So you have to have a safe place for people. You have to have bathrooms, you have to have showers, laundry, different types of things. And the Civic Center is just so expansive. When we, our team, looked at it, it would be very difficult for us to man and take care of. The other issue is that oftentimes you'd have to have security in there. You'd have to pay for security all the time as well. So we feel that that doesn't set up well for that. We do do our RFP on the Civic Center and say, what else can we imagine for the Civic Center? Merging Prairie had an event there the other night, very nicely attended, very nicely handled. And we have TEDx there. We have different events there that work very well. I'm asking for the community to come to me and say, here's what we'd like to do there. Some people want to put pickleball in there. You know, different people want to put different things in. So we're going to take a hard look at how can we make that a more usable center and more for community events.
You know, what's been the causes of the expanding Fargo homeless issue? I mean, increased population brings issues, of course, progress. What y'all's read? What is causing it?
So the state of North Dakota now is the number one state for people that are coming into the state in migrating to find jobs and to find things to do. So when that happens, you have an influx of people come try to find a job, does or does not work out, and oftentimes they'll end up on the streets. We used to have a safety net with on evictions. The state had a program which would help people if they were low on money or couldn't pay their rent. That's gone away. So what's happening is just confirmation of a lot of different things coming together at this time. Every city in the United States is having trouble with homelessness right now. It's a matter of trying to manage it in a manageable fashion. we may not make it all go away, but if we can get the numbers down to a comfortable level and work together with the people, we feel there's a window for us to do that and to continue to work to make it a better experience for everybody.
You know, does the Red River Community Service Center replace the engagement center? Or
they would replace it, but here's what we're trying to do at this time is we're bringing all the providers together, nonprofits and ourselves and different government entities, and saying, if you were going to build something or have something, what would be the best parts to have that? Right now, there's 30 nonprofits that work in the engagement center. Do we need Sanford to be part of it with their psych services? Do we need Ascension to be there, Prairie Psych? Do we need different partners that will help help us get through that? So right now, we're saying to people, if you have some ideas or think you can help us solve this issue, let's get together and do that. What the city commission is asking for is other partners to share the load. We spend about $600,000 on this on a yearly basis. And the idea is, are there other partners that can bring money, operation costs, and those types of things to the table to help us work on this issue?
What about possibilities of the center locations? Have you already identified some different locations as potentials?
So we've looked at 10 different locations as potential. The difficulty is that if I have to build from ground up, that would be fairly expensive, and I'd rather not do that. If I can find a used building somewhere where I could place it, I think that would be better. We're looking at a couple warehouse sites that look not so bad for doing that, and we'll just continue to vet what works best for the community. And that I hope to have an answer in the next couple months.
So, well, with that said, you know, when can citizens expect a commission vote on this?
Well, we'd like to have, we're working with all our partners to have a conceptual concept of what we need to have. That'll take 30 to 60 days just because you have to take input and takes time for people to figure that out. Some people had said, let's move it to Moorhead. Well, that doesn't work for a variety of different reasons, and it's more Fargo has an issue, and it seems kind of, well, we could just put it across the river. You really can't do that. Each entity has its mission, and you have to just combine all those mission statements and what they do, and then try to come up with what would be the best plan. We know in New York they've had a good chance of getting some of this done. We're looking at Houston. We're looking at some different cities, and what would be close to the best model. And I think, you know, what we try to do in the city of Fargo is learn from others, you know, learn from their mistakes, learn from their successes, and try to find a model that works, because we know all eyes are on us. So what we're trying to do is find a model that's proven, that works, and with consultants with Bloomberg, we're hoping that they help guide us a little bit on that of here's has worked in this community, let's try this here.
Well, Mayor, we're about out of time, but are there any other big issues you're focusing on for 2025?
Well, what I'd like to do, Red River Violet Water Supply is on the docket right now. We had some good news from the legislative body is that they said, can we build it quicker? I always like it when somebody says, can you build something quicker? The diversion is on time, on schedule. 27 is going to be fully operational, and I'm crossing my fingers again that we get through flood times without a flood for another couple of years, and that's really, we've been very fortunate that we're getting through that. And then I'm really excited, airport is now, the parking structure is coming up fairly nicely. It should be done this summer, and the addition is also progressing nicely. So we have a lot of stuff going on in our community.
Mayor, what's the best part of your job?
Best part of my job is talking to the voters and the people. We have great people in our community, and I love it. They don't always tell me what I'm doing right, but when they come up and say, Mayor, keep up the good work.
Well, there's a lot more we should talk about, but we are out of time. If people want more information, where can they go? Who can they contact?
So go to the City of Fargo website, and there's information on the website and all the different initiatives that we are doing. We got a lot of stuff going on. I'd like you to look at the State of the City video we have as well, and that kind of shows what the community is doing. Our wastewater plant just got done. So there's some cool stuff that the city does.
Mayor, good luck to you, and thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Andy Hall has been a full-time photographer for more than 20 years. Working out of his studio, Sweet Light Gallery in Crookston, Minnesota,
photography for me has been not only my profession for the last 20 plus years, but it is my way of communicating with the world. It's my way of sharing about things that I get to see, but it's also a way of creating images that are hopefully evocative for the viewer, but more importantly, it reflects what I'm trying to say. I opened Sweet Light Gallery in downtown Crookston about, it's coming up on 7 years ago now. This was my first foray into a gallery space. I lived in the Twin Cities for 20 some years and I had a shop there for 17 years, but it was strictly a working space. I've been doing art fairs that whole time. So when I moved up here about 10 years ago, this opportunity presented itself. I thought, wow, you have a storefront spot on downtown Crookston. Sure, I'm gonna throw my hat in the ring and see what happens. So it's been fantastic so far. I still end up doing far more art fairs than anything else. It's not quite a big enough community to live entirely on just what happens here at the gallery. So right now in Sweet Light Gallery, I have kind of four major categories of work up right now. I have landscape, kind of what would be termed traditional landscape location images. I have a whole series of images kind of called found object images or exploratory architecture images, typically old buildings, cool old rusty grubby things. I have a whole body of work that's abstract images, so long exposures of water, ice formations that are tiny, tiny, but when you make a big print out of it, it almost becomes unrecognizable as what it is. And then my most recent body of work is the botanical images. I kind of stumbled on this by mistake up here in the Red River Valley. I'm not originally from up here, so it took some time to kind of see and appreciate the beauty that is the prairie. So when I would be out hiking in the wintertime, either snowshoeing or cross-country skiing, I was just noticing all of the plants and the unbelievable amount of detail and structure and the way it was just whimsical, the way they moved the leaves. And I collected a few of them, brought them back to my gallery, and I put them in front of my camera. And I was just noticing how unbelievably captivating all of the movement was in these tiny, tiny little things that are, you know, the size of a dime or smaller in a lot of cases. That has just kind of lit a fire inside of me. It has me. It's grabbed me and it has me. So the technique that I have adopted for the prairie plants, and this will be a little bit techy, but I'm using focus stacking. So I start at the closest thing to me, I take a shot, and now I have this little 8-inch focusing rail that allows me to turn the dial and it moves the camera 1 millimeter per revolution. And so if I'm shooting a plant that's, you know, this much depth to it, I start here and I eventually take enough pictures where I have the entire thing in focus. And then I use software to stitch those together or layer them together, and that's called focus stacking. The ultimate cool thing about that is I have 100% control about the depth of field. See these two areas of sharpness here? I like that, and I like that part of the scene goes away. It's really, really a gratifying process too. And it is kind of software driven and hardware driven with the focusing rail. But that focus stacking has allowed me to get image quality that I've just never been able to get before. I love finding just the amazing in the everyday scene. That's really what I concentrate on. So when I go out to shoot landscape photos, I do not want to shoot what everybody else is shooting. There needs to be something to say with the image. I don't necessarily just want pretty pictures. I want emotion, something that evokes a reaction in people. I kind of naturally just push away from shooting the iconic. I am kind of the anti-iconic shooter. I want to see the super cool in what's right at my feet. I want to see the super cool things that are in northwestern Minnesota.
That was John Harris, the president and CEO of Prairie Public and host of Prairie Pulse. His guests were Fargo Mayor Dr. Tim Mahoney and photographer Andy Hall. The show is available to stream on PBS.org or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts, and it's aired on the television service of Prairie Public at 6:30 p.m. on Saturdays, right after North Dakota Legislative Review. Coming up on Main Street, Dr. Tom Ezern and his newest Plainsfolk essay, Maggie, a report from Harvest Media, This Week in Water, and Our Living Lands. That's all ahead on Main Street right after this.
Dakota Medical Foundation is reminding listeners of Giving Hearts Day, a 24-hour event supporting charities in North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota, Thursday, February 13th. Since 2008, Giving Hearts Day has connected donors with charities to help fund their missions and raise over $195 million. Learn more at givingheartsday.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Music has long shaped collective memory, especially on the Great Plains, where settlers carried cherished tunes across the prairie. In this installment of Plains Folk, Dr. Tom Ezern reflects on When You and I Were Young, Maggie, a song that transcended its Canadian origins to become a settlement anthem of love and loss for frontier communities. Sung on cattle trails, in schoolhouses, and at community gatherings, Maggie evoked nostalgia for a bygone era. With his signature blend of history and storytelling, Dr. Ezern explores how this poignant ballad connected generations, preserving both personal and cultural memories on the plains.
In writing and conversation, 19th century Americans commonly would drop phrases, deriving from popular songs of the day, and expect people, of course, to understand the connotation. On the prairies, for instance, any old place of residence might be referred to with nostalgic affection as the little old sod shanty on the claim. Similarly, in the way we today might say, back in the day, although I kind of hate that phrase, plains folk back in the day would say, when you and I were young, Maggie. I got to thinking about this song while reading Francis Edward Abernathy's book, Singing Texas. Abernathy, once president of the Texas Folklore Society, wrote a folk song book that was part memoir, part treatise. His chapter on cowboy songs draws heavily on the memory of his granddad, who was camp cook for the Sacuesta Ranch in northwest Texas. Abernathy intimates that not all cowboy songs were cowboy songs per se, and that the most popular song on the cattle trails was When You and I Were Young, Maggie, which singers eventually came to reference simply as Maggie. Now, I'm not sure the broader evidence supports Abernathy's assertion, but I do know that Maggie was a sentimentally iconic song in the settler society of the Great Plains, right up there with Lorena. I have sheet music of Maggie before me. Author George W. Johnson, music by J.A. Butterfield, published in Chicago, 1866. I wandered alone to the hill, Maggie, to watch the scene below. The creek and the creaking old mill, Maggie, as we used to long ago. The Canadian Encyclopedia and a feature in the Toronto Star confirm that the composer was Canadian, a schoolteacher in Glenbrook, Ontario, who wrote the poem in honor of his young wife, Margaret, and published it in a collection called Maple Leaves. Butterfield and his music publisher in Chicago picked it up from there. The poet persona is old and gray, and he revisits the scenes of a youthful courtship, including a graveyard that once was a meadow. The repetition of the name Maggie at end of line injects poignant punctuation into the stanzas, and the tune tugs the heartstrings. And now we are aged and gray, Maggie, the trials of life nearly done. Let us sing of the days that are gone, Maggie, when you and I were young. I doubt that if any of the Plains folk who sang Maggie and propagated it as a folk song with their own variations, certainly not the kids of Devil's Lake who performed it for end of school in 1910, nor the Kidder County homemakers who group sang it from memory at their achievement day in Tappan in 1937, none of them knew the truly sentimental backstory of the song. For Maggie, the darling bride of the poet, died of tuberculosis less than a year after they were married, before the poem became a song. If she ever revisited that meadow of her happy courtship, she did it as a spirit. So let the tears begin. Ah, when you and I were young, Maggie.
That's our dear friend, Dr. Tom Ezern, who shares his Plains Folk essays with us here on Main Street. Dr. Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Aronia berries, also known as chokeberries, are a native fruit packed with health benefits, but American growers struggle to find a strong market. While the berries thrive in the Midwest and offer high levels of antioxidants, their bitter taste has made them a tough sell. Efforts like Boulevard Brewery's Aronia Berry Creek aim to raise awareness, but farmers remain frustrated by limited demand. Meanwhile, researchers and entrepreneurs hope to boost consumption by promoting the fruit's nutritional value, as we hear in this report from Harvest Public Media.
Dozens of wine and bourbon casks are filled with aging beer at Boulevard Brewery's processing room in Kansas City. One of the brewers, Brent Cox, cracks open their latest creation. In Aronia Berry Creek. The beer is ruby colored. It smells funky and sweet. And the taste is
deep flavor. Kind of really reminds me of like the kind of wines I like.
For this beer, Boulevard partnered up with the botanical team at Powell Gardens to harvest their very own Aronia berries, more commonly known as chokeberries.
From like a brewer's standpoint, it's like always wanted to use native ingredients. It just kind of adds to the terroir and just the impact of flavors.
Aronia berries also can be made into syrup, wine, and juice. But while they're native to the U.S. and grow well in the Midwest, they haven't really caught on here. In fact, Poland is actually the world's largest producer.
You know, it's been tough going for the Aronia industry. I mean, the public awareness is not very high.
Dale Hilgenkamp is president of the American Aronia Berry Association and grows them on his farm in Arlington, Nebraska. His association estimates there are more than 1 million fruit bushes being grown, mostly on farms in Missouri, Iowa, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Wisconsin. But while Hilgenkamp says the bushes are easy to manage as a side crop, he says they have fewer members in the association than 8 years ago.
We just haven't been able to get any market development, haven't been able to get any, you know, larger companies on board to include Aronia in their products.
Yet, this berry has a long and rich history throughout North America. Chris Van Meter is a horticulturalist at Powell Gardens, the source for Boulevard Brewery's berries. He says Native Americans use them as a food source and even medicinally.
When dried and used in combination with other plants, they make a good tea, a good jam, and are really helpful due to their large number of antioxidants and curing colds.
In recent years, researchers have also found that the berry's properties could help with hypertension, obesity, and other chronic conditions. For Dean Duval, the berry's potential is what drew him in. He's a retired chemist who now grows it on his family's Century Farm in western Iowa. He says it's for agriculture and people.
It fits with the sustainable and regenerative agricultural movement, and not just the antioxidants. I mean, it's high in soluble fibers, it's high in vitamin C, so there's a lot of positives about it.
But more than anything, Duval just wants more folks to know that Aronia berries exist. He says consumers just need to be educated.
This is a native superfruit that they should be consuming. If they're out there spending money buying pomegranates or acai powder, they need to be taking a look at us.
Duval sells the berries when he can, but gives lots of them away to friends, family, and neighbors. He says they're perfect in smoothies. I'm Hector Alejandro Arzate, Harvest Public Media.
This story was produced in partnership with Harvest Public Media, a collaboration of public media newsrooms in the Midwest. It reports on food systems, agriculture, and rural issues.
Weather forecasting could become an unsafe free-for-all. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
The Trump administration appears to be dismantling the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, including the Weather Service, that warns about severe events like flooding, heat waves, hurricanes, and excessive winds and dryness that can lead to wildfires.
Multiple sources told the news outlet Axios that representatives of the new Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, were at NOAA headquarters in Silver Spring, Maryland, seeking access to IT systems and moving past security like it didn't apply to them.
Former officials said that the agency could lose half of its more than 12,000 employees and have its budget cut by 30%.
Democratic Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland cited reports that career staff had been locked out, and Democratic Representative Bruce Westerman of Arkansas, the ranking member of the House Natural Resources Committee, called for an investigation into what Musk and DOGE were doing at the agency.
In addition, it was reported that employees, including those at NOAA Fisheries, among others, had been ordered to cease communicating with foreign nationals. Fisheries, also known as the National Marine Fisheries Service, stewards the nation's ocean resources and seafood.
NOAA also monitors climate change. The goal to destroy the agency as it exists was promised in Project 2025, the Republican outline for the first 180 days of the new presidency.
Project 2025 said that the various offices inside NOAA had, quote, become one of the main drivers of the climate change alarm industry, and as such was harmful to future U.S. prosperity, unquote. The plan goes further to state that NOAA should be dismantled and many of its functions privatized, sent to other agencies, or placed under the control of states.
Last week, Trump nominated Neil Jacobs to head NOAA. Jacobs was reprimanded by the agency for his involvement in what is now referred to as Sharpiegate. In 2019, during his first term, Trump infamously used a marker to increase the path of Hurricane Dorian into Alabama. Jacobs penned a statement backing up the doctored image.
A local television forecaster in Denver, Colorado, Chris Bianchi, told 9 News that dismantling NOAA is like a plane losing its pilot. He said the National Weather Service is the gold standard for forecasting, and without their meteorologists, data, equipment, and models, it would be a free-for-all of incorrect and unsafe information.
In 1961, President John F. Kennedy signed the Foreign Assistance Act into law and created the U.S. Agency for International Development, known as USAID. Since its inception, the agency has helped to provide health programs, economic development, and clean water in more than 100 countries.
But its storied history is potentially coming to an abrupt end, with the White House calling the agency's work wasteful and not in line with what they say are American values. On February 3rd, nearly all personnel but a handful were placed on administrative leave. However, 4 days later, a federal judge temporarily paused that action, siding with unions representing the employees.
Elon Musk, Trump's cost-cutting advisor, boasted about feeding USAID into the wood chipper, despite the agency's funding being less than 1% of the federal budget.
Critics argue that the U.S. got a lot for that meager sum, starting with soft power, goodwill and influence with developing countries who now might turn to our adversaries for support.
Also, much of USAID's budget flows back to American businesses, such as farmers and ranchers, who sell about $2 billion a year in food aid. Nick Lewandowski, executive director of the Kansas Farmers Union, told the Washington Post that farmers are already struggling with low prices, rising costs, and the potential impacts of tariffs.
Lewandowski also told WBUR that Musk might have targeted USAID because he was under investigation by the agency's inspector general for the Starlink satellite terminals he provided to the government of Ukraine. It's been reported that over the last 4 years, Musk has received $1 million from USAID to bring Starlink to Zimbabwe and South Africa.
Meanwhile, there's enormous potential harm to millions of people globally who lack access to safe drinking water, sanitation, and hygiene, and also rely on U.S. humanitarian aid. That assistance is in the long-term interest of the U.S. by reducing food and water insecurity, which can create conflict and cross-border migration.
USAID and its partners also create stability around the globe by helping countries monitor ecosystem health, increase agricultural productivity, and build resilience to climate change.
Last, the agency is a watchdog for global health crises. Andrew Natsios, who ran USAID under President George W. Bush, said that news this week of an Ebola outbreak in Uganda was reported by none other than a USAID mission.
Natsios, a lifelong conservative Republican, told Politico that Trump's move to shutter USAID is both illegal and outrageous. According to the Congressional Research Service, a president cannot legally abolish USAID. Only Congress can if it's willing to act. That's it for this week in water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
I'm Antonia Gonzalez, and this is Our Living Lands. Invasive species are among the biggest drivers of biodiversity losses around the world. They're also increasingly affecting tribal lands, and climate change is making it worse. Mitzi Reed is an enrolled citizen of the Mississippi Band of Choctaw Indians. She also leads the Native American Fish and Wildlife Society's Invasive Species Program. The Mountain West News Bureau's Rachel Cohen spoke with her.
Why are invasive species a particular concern for tribes?
Tribes are unique in that they have this holistic relationship with their lands, be it for sustenance, subsistence, medicine, ceremony, arts, even economical use. The health of their ecosystem is vital to their way of life. And so the presence and the spread of invasive species threatens that way of life. I think that's the biggest result of all the conversations I've had with tribes is that they're concerned that they're losing their way of life.
And one thing that can exacerbate that change is climate change. When you think about how climate change could impact native species or is already affecting them, what comes to mind for you?
So yes, non-native species are often more resilient to higher temperatures. They're more resilient to water limitations or even water overages. You know, we see more flooding, we see more storm surges. That obviously leads to a loss of our native species, which opens the door for invasive species to thrive. Basically, we just need to think of climate change as a boost that increases in invasive species' negative impacts by promoting new invasions, in a sense.
One example that comes to mind for me is the invasive mussels, which threaten native fish like salmon that tribal members rely upon for sustenance. And earlier this year, I talked with Anthony Capatillo about this after invasive quagga mussels were discovered in the Snake River in Idaho. And he's a biologist and Nez Perce tribal member.
We really do have the most to lose here. And if we do lose all of lose parts of our identity, lose our resources, we can't really measure what those losses are, you know, and they're basically, you can't reconcile those losses either.
So I think he's saying that the native species are really ingrained in his culture.
I totally agree. I mean, it comes down to it's not just affecting, you know, our lands or what we can see. It's affecting, you know, our past, our traditions, you know, what our ancestors tried to thrive for us. It threatens all of that too.
So we've been talking about new introductions, but you also work with invasive species that have been around for generations, and ones that indigenous communities might have even gotten used to. That sounds like it could make your work complicated.
Most definitely. That is definitely a consideration that we've started incorporating in our discussions with tribes about management planning, because there are species that have been adapted to. I mean, tribal people have been here for millennia, and they've had to adapt with what's around them because they lived off the land. And so there may have been a species that was non-native that came in, but it's been utilized as a food source. It's been utilized as a medicine. It's been utilized for ceremony.
And I know you said you work with tribes that have varying degrees of wildlife programs or invasive species programs. What would you want to share with anyone who might be listening in those communities about why this work is important?
I think the biggest thing is recognizing that the sooner we can get to controlling a problem, the easier it is to control that problem. So I think I'd push active management, you know, get out there, know what you've got, and let our native plants thrive and work at protecting our livelihood.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 11th. On this date, in 1904, Patrick Gorneau was born at Turtle Mountain. Rushed by sleigh to the priest for baptism and given little chance of survival due to his premature birth, his aunt Shayush, a well-known healer and midwife, created a shoebox incubator and cared for him until he could thrive. Pat later became her apprentice, learning to gather medicinal plants and gaining expert knowledge of nature, creatures, and plant ecology. Due to epidemics and poverty on the reservation, Pat had to attend government boarding schools at Wahpeton, Fort Totten, and Haskell, where he learned skills like blacksmithing, barbering, harness and shoemaking, dairying, farming, and writing. His penmanship and ability to express himself became valuable life skills, helping him form lifelong friendships and political alliances. After finishing eighth grade, Pat traveled across the country helping his family. He and a friend worked as security in Mexico, but upon seeing U.S. Marines, they escaped under cover of night, heading north. In East Grand Forks, Minnesota, Pat worked for a truck farmer, learned the trade, and married the farmer's daughter. He eventually bought land at Turtle Mountain, starting a family farm business. They lived in an 1880 oak log cabin built by fur traders. Pat's green thumb and innovative methods attracted customers for miles around, selling produce to farm wives, grocery stores, and hotels for 23 years. As tribal chairman, Pat improved conditions for his people. In the 1950s, when the Bureau of Indian Affairs sought to end federal recognition of the Turtle Mountain tribe, Pat fought back. With support from allies like Ed Jolie and Martin Old Dog Cross, the termination bill was defeated. Pat had a stroke after a trip to Washington, D.C., but his efforts were successful. Pat later worked as a night watchman at the Turtle Mountain Ordnance Plant, and after retirement, promoted tribal traditions through powwows and historical booklets. He conducted ceremonies with a peace pipe passed down from his grandfather, who had used it at the 1863 Old Crossing Treaty and 1870 Fort Abercrombie Peace Treaty. Pat Gorneau's cultural revival inspired future generations. He conducted naming ceremonies for dignitaries and wrote The History of the Turtle Mountain Chippewa and other works. His life and legacy also inspired Louise Erdrich's Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, The Night Watchman. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lise Erdrich. I'm Meryl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
And that's it for this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. Thank you so much for joining us. Tomorrow on the show, Dr. Ivan Meisner. He's a former Red Cross Humanitarian of the Year, and he'll talk about seven ways we all can make an impact in our world. How do we build our legacy and make a difference, even if we think we can't? That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.